All right, gang. So, you should have gotten some emails from Patty yesterday. One from Jeff with chart that you guys, he had to scribble down because our projector is fighting us again. Kill that fly. And then the other was about the retreat. So, a couple details just to give to you in case you didn't read emails, which you should. They're good to read. It's going to be a rough morning. It's my smoothie. You're not having any. Bring sheets, sleeping bag, or something. We are responsible for laundry, so to do 20 people's laundry of sheets and towels is, we would have to start when we get there. So just bring your own, or shower before you come, okay? Showers are not mandatory, but deodorant is, okay? So if you don't want to, that's fine. But bring your own whatever. So this place is gigantic. There's plenty of room for all of us, so you can sleep in beds or floor, whatever you want, but we'll make that work. So that's kind of the deal with that. Just bring your own stuff. Fellas, we will take care of breakfast Saturday morning, okay? So probably bacon, eggs, pancakes, something like that. I did put a girl in charge of shopping for us and said make sure that you don't buy all guy food. So there will be things that are nutritious and not full of lard and pigs, okay? So as wonderful as all those things are to eat, I'm supposed to be fighting childhood obesity for a living, so that's my organization. Anyway, so I have to eat healthy sometimes. Don't tell anybody. So that's kind of the deal with that. So Thursday night, we will just kind of hang and do some kind of fun stuff. So homework for you guys is I have a lot of really bad ideas of what we could do Thursday, and if yours are better than mine, then we'll do yours, okay? So I need a good get to know you, icebreaker, fun, 20 people, everybody participates, most everyone gets embarrassed type game, okay? I've got a couple ideas that'll work. Again, they're probably C+. But I can't tell you. You guys ever played, I'll tell you. You ever played Three Truths and a Lie?
Yeah.
Okay, that's one. It's a great, like, you get to hear people lie, which is always good, right? Especially in residency, so. Anyway, so, but I am wide open to suggestions, okay? So Thursday night, we're just gonna hang, Thursday night, Friday night? Friday night, not tonight. Whoa, what just happened?
So later on tonight.
Yes, later on tonight, we're all hanging out at my house.
Place.
That would be odd. So we'll hang and do that, okay? So if you have ideas, I'd love to hear them. So you Energizer game players, WSM specialist, all ears, okay? Saturday morning, we'll eat breakfast, hang out. It'll be a little bit more, our hangout time will be a little bit more on the spiritual side, less hang out in terms of goofing off. Dude, that flies, literally. I'm gonna lose my salvation right now. Nope, just lost it. Got it back, good. Where was I, sorry. It's like one of those mornings. I woke up at 2:30 and could not go back to sleep, so I've had way too much coffee, and I'm gonna take a nap at like 8:30, so. Wow, welcome to my life, sorry. Saturday, spiritual stuff, okay? So that'll be kind of our deal, and then we'll head home after lunch, okay? Lunches will be make your own sandwich, adventure, stuff like that, okay? Questions, thoughts? Somebody talks, I don't have to anymore. Let's take a quick cat nap.
Do you want us to, like, email you suggestions or anything?
Yes, or just in the middle of me teaching, did they just scream them out randomly? No, email would be better. Let's do email. Yes. Email, holler at me afterwards, whatever. Cool? Somebody please pray for us and me, and we'll start if we can.
Heavenly Father, thank you so much again for another day to be filled up with your word, Lord. Lord, as we try to be students of the text, we realize that we need you to show up every day, that your Holy Spirit is what brings the text to life and gives it meaning for us, Lord. So we ask that you would show up today, be present, and teach us, Lord, and continue just to fill us up with you and reduce the amount of me, Lord. In your name we pray.
Amen. All right. So, Proverbs 20, verse 4, we will begin there. So, somebody read that when they get there. Proverbs 20, verse 4. All right, the sluggard does not plow. Yours says in the autumn. Mine says after the autumn. Literally in the Hebrew, it means from the winter, okay? You guys are going to learn when we get to Israel, the kind of the cool thing about the Central Valley is their climate is very similar to ours. Their seasons are very similar to ours. So when you think, gosh, what's it like in Israel in October? It's like it is in the valley. It's like, oh, it's cooling off. Summer's over. It's nice, right? Rain's coming for them just like it does for us, right? I grew up in Texas in totally different climate. So just it rains whenever. In California or in Fresno, it's only allowed to rain in this window. And outside of that, it doesn't. It's weird, right? But you know we're going to get 200 whatever days of beautiful smog-filled air, okay? But it'll be clear, at least, in terms of rain. So slugger does not plow after the autumn. Why would one not plow after the autumn or from the winter? Tell me about, and again, agrarian society, we understand this.
Crops don't grow in the winter.
Crops don't grow in the winter. Well, they're not growing crops. What are they doing for crops? Plowing, which is what? You're preparing the land, right? What's plowing like? Describe it for me. Is that easy work? Not so much. Okay. What's the climate like when you're out plowing in winter? It's cold. It's unpleasant, right? Do you see any immediate return on your labor when you're plowing? Do you plow and then look behind you and there's a crop that's growing? No, right? You have to do temporarily painful, unpleasant things that result in immediately nothing, right? Hence, the slugger doesn't want to do that. I'd rather stay inside and be by the warm fire and not get wet. And I really don't care to wake up at 4:30 in the morning like a farmer has to and work 12-hour days and get my fields ready for when it's nicer outside and I can sow my seed, okay? So as a result, what happens to said sluggard? So months later, when it's time to harvest those crops that he planted or didn't plant because he didn't do the work necessary on the front end, he's got nothing, right? You think if you'd asked that sluggard in November, December, in the rainy season in Israel, hey, would you like barley or wheat or lots of grapes in your bin come harvest? You think he would have said, no, I'm not really interested in that. I like poverty, don't really want to eat, my family's not important. Probably not, right? He probably said, no, I actually would like that. Those sound great. But he is not willing to do the things that it takes to get there, okay? What's the lesson in this for us? Why is this here? Why would Solomon be telling his kid this? What's the difference between a sluggard and one that is successful? Is it dreams? Is it what they want? Is it desires? No, they have the same desires. What's the difference? Willing to put in the effort, right? Willing to do temporarily things that are temporarily uncomfortable in a season where you see no results, right? Any of you guys runners? Anybody ever run half marathon, marathon? Man, I watched my wife when I was in grad school. She decided she was going to run a half marathon. She had a full-time job, so it was like, okay, I've got to be at work at 8, you know, start backing up the clock. So she started. She realized, okay, if I'm going to do long runs and don't have time on the weekend or whatever it was, I've got to get up at 4:30 in the morning when it's dark and go run in the winter in Texas. And it was miserable. And I would literally, I'd roll over and just laugh at her, go right back to bed. I'm like, no, thank you. I want no part of that. Well, in order to do that, she knew that that's what it would take. It's unpleasant. It's not fun. But she had a goal, something that she was willing to do, right? Running's not fun throughout the winter in Fresno either. It's painful to get up in the morning and do that and to lose sleep, and you guys understand that, right? This is when my riding schedule tends to get a lot less frequent because I don't like getting up early and being freezing when I get on the bike. But that's what it takes if you want to do well in the races that are coming in February. The people that win those races in February are the people that ride their bikes in November. And it's you guys know the strategy and everything behind that, right? We live in a immediate gratification universe. I want what I want right now. With technology and all the things that we have our hands on, we want answers, we want results immediately. This is an old school concept that is quickly fading, especially I think with this generation because of the access that we have to information and everything around us, okay? So this is what pays off in the long run. Okay, there are some things that you can't just snap your fingers and get. Okay, it's not a Burger King universe your way right away all the time. Okay, so note to self, this is a great quality when people have that about them, that have an internal drive that says, you know what, I've got a goal, I want that. And I realize in order to get to that, I need to do A, B, C, and D before I'm ever going to get to Z. And if I don't do those things, I will never get what I want. That is true physically. It is also very true spiritually, right? If I want to grow, if I want to change, if I want to see these results, there are tangible physical things that I must do in my life in order to get there, okay? So, great reminder for all of us. This is true on every level of our lives, and the people that can do that end up having great results, okay? One of the thrusts of Off the Front is teaching this concept to 10-year-olds, right? You're going to earn a bike, but it's August, and you don't get to earn a bike until June. We're asking you to do 9 months of hard work in order to do it. You're not going to get it tomorrow. So they have to be willing to do these things that we're asking them to do with no return on their investment for a long time, okay? And we're hoping that we can teach kids that skill and that concept early on, because it's one that if they can translate into life, we'll see them through it in a number of places, okay? Thoughts, commentary on that? Nothing? Okay. Genesis. Back to Noah. So we finished up in chapter 6, I think, last week. Did we get all the way through that? Mostly? I think we're kind of right towards the end. So, big picture. Again, we watch God command after this whatever tragedy happened in 6 verses, 6, 1 and following. With this Nephilim and the sons of God, the result of that ended up with God saying, man, we're going to hit the reset button. We're doing a do-over. We're going to take life from the earth, and we're going to start over. Because of verse 6, five rather, that the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great and that the intent of man's thoughts were on evil continually. We're going to find out, because 8 people still survived this thing, whether or not this all changes. Okay, did God wipe out every sinner from the earth, and is there now a new righteous earth? I think you guys obviously understand the answer to that question before we even get there. But obviously, this is not going to solve all of man's problems, because we have an inherent problem called sin. Okay, so God says we're going to do it over. Verse 6, he's grieved in his heart. He's sorry. So God, again, can grieve. He emotes. He feels deeply about the treasure and the crown of his creation. He picks Noah, says, build a boat, okay? Again, in a strange day, we've never seen rain. We've got this vapor canopy that still exists over the earth that we'll see kind of, God's going to stick a push pin in it here in a bit, and that's where much of the rainfall that's going to come is coming from, okay? He promises in verse 18 that, hey, I'm going to establish my covenant with you, kind of this first time we've seen this actual wording where he says, Noah, I promise to do this. I promise to protect you, to remove you from judgment that's coming, or to see you through it while it comes. We're going to take 2 of every kind in this thing, this ark, this big boat, and we're going to go from there, okay? So chapter 7, verse 1, let's pick up there. Let's see how this thing kicks off. Noah has been commanded to bring, kind of by the sovereign hand of God, 2 of everything into the ark at the end of chapter 6. And then God's going to ask him to do something different, and it sounds almost like a repeat, 7, verse 1. Read that.
Then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before men in this generation.
We're going to see that that's named. It's obviously Noah, his wife, Shem, Ham, Japheth, okay, and their 3 wives, okay? So my count is 8. For some reason, I had 10 in my head. If someone else counts something different, holler, I've got a note. But in my understanding, we got 8 people that are going to make it on the ark, okay? So Noah's 3 kids, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, whose names will be very important as we continue our story, they're getting on the ark. Now, verse 2, keep going there.
Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals, the male and his mate, and a pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and 7 pairs of the birds of the heavens also, male and female, to keep their offspring alive on the face of all the earth.
Now, Noah's already gotten everything, right? So there's 2 of every kind on the ark. And God now goes back and says, you're going to take with you clean animals and those that are not clean, okay? And you're going to bring those on, birds of the sky. And he kind of goes in detail there in 2 and 3. What is this about? Why is God having Noah get now more animals to bring on the ark?
Sacrifice.
Yeah, these are going to be the sacrifices when they get off the boat, okay? So clean animals and unclean animals, all right? And then notice verse 4, what God makes Noah do.
Verse 4.
7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground.
All right, so it's interesting. I think we may even mention this last week, or it actually went through my head, not out my mouth. But so Noah's got to get on the boat, and then what? How long does he have to sit there before God brings rain?
7 days.
7 days. Like, what do you think everybody's doing right now? When God's put him on there, God shut the door. Hey, Noah, you're an idiot, right? I mean, dude, there's no rain. This is the guy that builds the rocket in his backyard and climbs in. He's like, okay. It's funny for a little bit, and then all of a sudden it's like, wow, I look really stupid. God, hello, right? So God could have brought rain 7 days prior to that, right? I think he made Noah sit in there and say, do you trust me? Do you really believe that I'm going to do something that you have never seen before? No one understand it. And I would imagine when you build this is a structure that you could have seen for miles. This thing is as big as a football field. It's huge. And people are, football field and a half, right? People had to know it was there. It took forever to build. And they absolutely laughed their heads off at Noah, right? I mean, it had to be comical at some point. Until the rain started coming, right? So, and that's the sad day, okay? So, rain's coming in 7 days. So, it rains, as we see in verse 4, for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, God says, I'm going to blot out from the face of the land every living thing that I have made, okay? Now, there's been a lot of debate about, was this really a worldwide flood, right? Or was it just local to the world that Noah knew? It seems based on what God says that when he says all and every, he means all and every, everything. So I am a firm believer that this thing was worldwide, okay? So everything that was not on the ark, everything died, okay? Other than the 8 people and all the animals, 2 by 2s that God allowed to come in, okay? So let's see here. We get a bit more on Noah and his wife. Notice that he is 600 years old. That had to be rough making an ark at that age, right? So he's he gets on, he's that age, okay? He's got the clean animals. And then in verse 10, keep picking up there. Actually, Jared, you're wonderful. Someone else other than Jared, read, please.
And after 7 days, the water of the flood came upon the earth.
Keep going.
In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened.
Somebody do some great hermeneutics for me and tell me what just happened in verse 11. All the fountains of the deep burst open. Okay, what are the fountains of the deep? We've heard about those before. How does the earth get watered at this point? Yeah, so every PVC pipe in the world just blew. Okay, the automatic sprinkler system just went off. Okay. All of it right now, okay? So that's that. What's the rest of that? The floodgates of the sky were opened. What does that imply? It rained a whole lot, okay? Now, there is not enough water from condensation and such in the way that we think about rain to absorb rain from the oceans and turn it into, you guys know the deal, you all took 7th grade, you know, geography, geoscience, whatever it was. Whatever, geography too, it's important. There's not enough rain. There's not enough water to fill the earth. So there had to be water that came from somewhere else. This is, in my understanding, the vapor canopy, the greenhouse that has been the earth, just got a pushpin pushed in it. Water came from below and water came from above, and it covered everything. The entire world is now underwater during the 7 days, okay? So it took 7 days for this thing to empty itself, and now that environment that these animals grew up in and that Noah and all that the generations before him grew up in is about to change, okay? So that is how we get that much water on the earth that Everest would be, that you could swim up to it, right? That's a lot of water, okay? So vapor canopy above, floodgates from below, or the fountain from below, and rain fell, verse 12, for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, so that's what we see. Notice verse 16. Read that.
And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in.
Good. Just again, a reminder, God's in charge of this whole thing. There's no sail, there's no rudder, there's no mast. Noah doesn't even close the door. God physically shuts the door and says, I will see you through this time. Okay. Verse 17, 40 days and 40 nights, water increased and lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. It prevailed, verse 18, greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the surface of the water. So what an odd sight, right, to be in the middle of this sea of what used to be land days before, and now there is nothing but water, okay? If you guys have ever been out in a boat at night or whatever, that it's kind of a creepy feeling. So it really is. You guys ever watch Man vs. Wild? You ever seen that show? You're not saved if you haven't, okay? All the guys are like, absolutely. The girl's like, what? You need to watch it. There's an episode where they stick Bear Grylls out in, it's in the middle of an ocean. I forget which one. It may have been the Gulf of Mexico or something. Anyway, but it's like, you guys remember the opening scene of Tom Hanks? Thank you. Where they have the shot of it raining, he's on the raft, and they keep pulling back, and it's darker and darker, and the lightning's coming, and you're just, you have that, like, oh God, that would be so horrific. I cannot imagine anything more terrifying than just being literally in the middle of nowhere, alone, it's raining, and I'm on the water. Like, oh, right? They did a, and there's a whole Man vs. Wild episode about it, where literally, there's like a, you know, they have a safety vessel that's like a mile away from him. He loses contact with them. So what started off is, okay, we've got our safety checks in place. That's gone. And you can kind of see the panic meter rising in him. And he's like, okay, this is not funny anymore. So like, I have no idea if I'm, and literally he thinks he's going to die at one point. So if you haven't read the autobiography, it's also very good. Okay. Side note. And he's a believer, which is really cool. You got to think this was a weird spot to be in for Noah, right? And you think what comes with rain, thunder, and lightning, I imagine all of that was, I don't know, I'm guessing, but had to be an interesting experience to say the least, okay? Verse 22, notice what happens.
Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died.
So if you're not in the ark, everything dies. Okay, so it's a sad reality, but that was God's plan, okay? He blotted out, verse 23, every living thing that was on the face of the land, okay? So that's how it goes, okay? So we now get rain for 40 days, verse 24, last verse of chapter 7, the water prevailed on the earth for 150 days, okay? So it stops raining after 40 days, 150 days after it starts raining, the water is still there, and now it's beginning to recede, okay? 8 verse 1, in the midst of all this chaos, what happens?
But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him.
Now think about that. Noah's been on this boat for four and a half months. At what point are you like, hello, God, right? That had to be a pretty creepy sensation of, Lord, have you forgotten us? Like, we've been doing this a while. You know, I could use a stretch break and get off and see some land at some point, right? That God still remembers his promise to Noah. As he said on the way in, get in the boat. I'm going to make my covenant with you. I will take care of you. So,
yeah, monkeys going crazy.
A whole lot would be going crazy, right?
They didn't get out after the
40 days. No. Noah is on the boat, by the way, 377 days. I'm sorry, Evan, you've been waiting very patiently.
So, is that like dead people floating around everywhere?
Yes. You'll see in a second. Yeah. I don't know. Part of it, I guess, is the trust factor and Noah, will you trust me? And but yeah, there would have been quicker ways to do this, right? Yeah. And this is going to be so horrific that God literally says, I'll never do this again. Like this had to be, you talk about like emotional trauma. That had to screw you up pretty good, right? So God basically says at the end of it, this will never, ever happen again. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, okay, so 150 days, they're on so far. Water begins to recede. God remembers Noah. The fountains of the deep, verse 2, and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained. Okay, the water recedes, verse 13, steadily from the earth. In the seventh month, on the 17th day, I think they started in the second month. I had some chart I was looking at earlier. And they land, the ark rests, verse 4, on Mount Ararat, okay? Anybody can find that, you're going to make a lot of money, okay? No idea where the ark is, okay? So lots of people have conjectured, lots of people have fragments of the ark laying around that they won't show anybody, okay? So if you ever watch the Discovery Channel, you can find out all about it, okay? No one has a clue, okay? So whatever. But that's where it rests, okay? Noah is told in verse, well, is not told, but he does this in verse 6. Read this.
Days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth.
Okay, so Noah, he's got, you remember that little window at the top, that's all he's got, so he can peek out and, nope, still out of water. No, it's still raining. Let's go, let's play some more gin rummy, right? I don't know. He sends out a raven. What type of bird is a raven? Scavenger. Evan, what is everywhere on the earth right now? Water and dead bodies. So if you're a raven, what do you call that? It's called a buffet, okay? You've got your pick of the litter. Like, what dead carcass do you want to go feed on, right? A little buffalo, some cow, maybe some human. I don't know, okay? That's kind of gross. But the idea is he's a scavenger, right? These birds are filthy animals, okay? Hence the unclean birds that Noah brought on the ark. So he sends out a raven, okay? An unclean animal, and he finds in verse 7, it says he flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth, okay? Does the raven come back? No. Why would he come back? I don't want to know any part of Noah, right? I found that's home for me, okay? Unclean, dead bodies. Dead animals, dead everything. Man, that's heaven for this guy, okay? Verse 8, interesting contrast.
Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him.
Okay, stop right there. Okay, so we get another bird. What kind of bird is listed here in verse 9? Dove. What's a dove like?
Not a carnivore.
No, it's not gonna eat meat. So it's going to go out in that world, and it's going to see the same things that the raven has seen, and the things that brought the raven satisfaction, will the dove find satisfaction in those things? No. So what does the dove do? Returns to Noah, okay? What do we say Noah's name means? Rest. Verse 9, but the dove found no resting place. No, Noah is literally the Hebrew, okay? The root word of resting is, I think it's Noah's name is, it's Manoah, I think is how it's pronounced, the no resting place. So the dove goes out and finds no Noah out in the world and then does what? Comes back to who? To Noah, the person that brings him rest, okay? Really cool spiritual implications here, okay? You guys ever wondered, like, hey, how do you know if someone's a Christian? How do you truly know, like, man, are they saved? Has there been life change? We can't ever fully measure it, but one of the great measuring rods is, did the things that used to bring you joy and satisfaction, or the things that you thought would bring you those things, are those things still satisfying to you? Can you go out into the world and find rest? When you see a buffet of all the things that the world has to offer, is that the ultimate plan for you? Do you enjoy those things? Or after conversion, you go, you know what? Man, my sin nature still has an appeal to those things. And yes, there's still a part of me that desires things of the world and the things that it has to offer. But ultimately, there is no rest for me in those things. I cannot be satisfied in what the world has to offer. And as a result, I have to come back to Noah, to my father, and find rest in him, okay? It's just a great kind of picture of the salvation that is the ark, okay? One finds rest there, one does not. One is fine leaving the father and being away forever. The other says, you know what? No, all that has to offer, it's not for me. I'm going to return to the ark. Okay, so again, just kind of a picture. I don't think Noah wrote that for us so that we would interpret that spiritually, but it's an interesting picture nonetheless.
Stephen? Kind of random question. Is there any significance that it specifies that the dove was a female?
I don't know. I've never noticed that. Good observation. I like your hermeneutic skills. but I didn't know.
Kind of got a kick out of that. It made me laugh. It almost seems like Noah like sent out the Ravens like, oh, didn't come back.
Yeah, kind of like, why did I expect any different, right?
Next bird.
Yeah, yeah. You wonder if Noah kind of realized, I'm not going to find out what I want to find out from that bird, right? But God had to bring those on there for a reason. So that had to be, had to be a good reason for that, okay? Now, verse 10, keep reading again.
He waited another 7 days, and again he set forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf.
So what does the dove find? Life, right? Which means there's what now?
There's land.
Somewhere. Right? Waits another 7 days. Verse 12, sent it out again, and the dove did not return, because the dove has now found rest in new life that's out there. Okay, so very cool. So now they know, okay, it's good. Verse 13, we kind of get the full picture there of how long Noah's been there. Again, 377 days there on the ark. God says to Noah, verse 16, read that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how long have they been waiting to hear that? Like, oh, thank God, right? Yes. What did that ark smell like after 377 days? You know, just, okay. Just using all the senses here, right? Not pleasant. So, in verse 17, what's the command?
Bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth.
Get off the ark, be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth, right? Don't settle. Go and multiply, okay? So that's a good thing. Noah went out, his sons and his wives with him, every beast and every creeping thing, every bird, everything that moves on the ark went out with their families from the ark. So God says, go, okay? So rain's gone, 377 days on the ark, judgment is past. God says the same thing he said to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth, okay? Verse 20, notice Noah's first inclination when he gets off the ark. Read that.
Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of everything animal and some of everything bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar.
Yeah, can you imagine if he had forgotten to bring those extra animals? Like, ooh, there went the unicorn. that's why. That was the clean animal that Noah just offered. So, right, that's why they were there. But you see Noah's heart in that, right? Get off the boat. God, you're amazing. Offering immediately, okay? Cool deal. We don't see that commanded. That's Noah's response of worship. Now, God may have said that to him. I don't know. He told him to bring those animals on for a reason. So maybe God told him. He had a lot of time to think on the ark, right? Or to talk to God or what have you. But it's neat to see Noah's knee-jerk response is worship, okay? Yeah. He's about to live both extremes. This amazing obedience, and now he's about to get hammered. So you're like, Noah, really? Like, dude, you're just like me. So great obedience, and then, boy, you turn around for a second, and he's sinning again, right? So we'll see that here in a second, right? This is an odd response. Just think about this from the Lord's perspective. Read 21. God is seeing Noah offer this burnt offering, and here's God's perspective.
When the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done.
Yeah, okay, so God says that smell is soothing. You guys ever smelled burnt hair? It's filthy. There are a few smells that are more distinguishable and more disgusting than that, okay? I want you to notice something about God, and this is cool. When he builds later the tabernacle and then ultimately the temple, it is a full-on every sensory experience, okay? The things you see, the things you hear, the things you touch, the things you smell, he involves all your senses. So though this smell to us is abhorrent, you would go, oh, it's hideous, right? To God, it's the smell of worship, right? That's why I woke up last night at 2:30 in the morning, coming down my street. There was like eight of them. I'm like, what just happened? So Well, maybe they're coming to get us. They stopped right there. Thank you again. You've now interrupted me twice today. Anyway, so it's just fascinating to me, right? That is a smell that God goes, that's the smell of worship. That's the smell of obedience, okay? So neat to see it from Noah, all right? God says, never going to do this again, and he's going to give Noah now a promise, okay? Here in just a second. Before that, kind of a fascinating interjection by God, okay? God says, verse 1, be fruitful, multiply. In verse 2, something different. Read verse 2. What happens now that they're off the boat? Now, what just changed? Yeah, why is it? And maybe not just a distrust, but why would God put the fear of man into all animals? Yeah, so there's a sense that, what's God about to do? What's about to change in terms of Noah's diet? Absolutely, right? So they used to eat, you know, asparagus and broccoli and cauliflower, and now it's like, dude, get some steak with that, okay? That's about to change. Now, you put up man versus tiger. Who's winning that battle? It's not a competition, right? We can't run very fast. We have no means of self-protection. It's a losing battle, right? So God says, as a result to protect you, I'm going to put the fear of you in all of them, because mano a mano, you would get, you know, you would get the smackdown from every animal. So God is gracious to say they're going to naturally fear you, okay? Which, you go to a zoo, you go out in the wild, you see that all the time. It's still true today, okay? There is a fear of man in every animal, okay? Verse 3, here's the green light. Read that. All right, so vegetarians, sorry, God says eat meat, eat good, okay? So if you want to eat vegetables, knock yourself out, okay? I will enjoy some cow. So Noah's now allowed to eat of the animals, okay? But there's a restriction, verse 4.
But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood.
Okay, so everything's good except for sushi, okay? Sushi is evil and wrong, okay? That was a joke. Golly, you guys need drink coffee. I don't like sushis, but no. Okay, so why would God say don't eat animals with the blood in it? What does that mean? What is he saying? What's that?
Don't eat anything that's alive.
Don't eat it alive. I mean, more so past that. Cook it. Okay. What does cooking do? It's obviously healthy. It's hygienic. Okay. Why the blood? Why is God specifically bringing that up? Do not eat anything that has the blood in it. Surely I will require your lifeblood, verse 5, from every beast and require it, and from man, from every man's brother, I will require that of man. Okay? So God's like, just the blood? No, don't eat that. Don't drink that, don't whatever. Why is that important? Why is blood significant?
Blood symbolizes life.
Okay, what else? What did we see it symbolize? Genesis 3, verse 21. Adam and Eve put coverings over themselves. God said, no, that's no worky.
Payment for sin.
Payment for sin. Blood has always been, as early as Genesis 3, and even here again, the payment for sin. Blood is spiritual. Blood is important. Blood is the atonement. It's a picture. So God says, I don't want you to just handle it recklessly, okay? It's a picture of how I'm going to cover your sin, okay? So cook the blood out of it. Drain the blood, okay? If you're ever on crazy, weird mission trips in Africa, I've heard a lot of missionaries that have been faced with that dilemma. What do I do? They eat blood. They drink blood of animals or whatever. It's just part of the cultural thing. And they've had to make a decision to, do I offend this people? Do I obey Genesis 9? Is that still around today? Right? So there are people groups today that find much value in that. Okay? And we look at that and go, that's filthy. And then there's people that look at us and go, really? A medium rare steak? That's disgusting, okay? That would never do that. That would be totally offensive to them, right? See, also India, okay? So, to each their own, all right? Then in verse 6, God now issues a command. Read that, or a promise.
Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. And you be fruitful and multiply, team on the earth and multiply in it.
Okay, so verse 7 we've seen before. Verse 6, what's new here? What's God saying?
No murdering.
Okay, no murdering. If you take someone's life, what's the penalty for that?
Your life will be taken.
Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You guys have heard this before, okay? How about the image of God? Did the image-bearing nature of man change as a result of the fall? Is Noah still in the image of God? Absolutely. After the fall, are humans still made in the image of God? Absolutely. Okay, the 50-cent theological term is defaced, but not erased. Do we bear God's image in the same way that Adam did pre-fall? No. Do we still bear the image of God? Absolutely. Okay, remember that. Humankind still has value because God has deemed them worthy. We are image bearers of God. And he reminds Noah of that. You were still made in my image. As a result, you do not take another's life. Okay? And if you do, your life will be required for it. What do we call that today? What is that concept called? You kill somebody, someone can kill you. Capital punishment, okay, that is what it's called, okay? Question, is this still around today? Or is this only an Old Testament concept? Did God say, hey, for a season, Old Testament, capital punishment's how we're gonna live, but one day you guys are gonna mature and we're gonna grow out of this? Right, and any good FPU student would say that, okay? I don't know if you are or not. But folks that tend to be a more passive leaning would say, no, Jesus changed that. See also the Sermon on the Mount. You know, someone slaps you, offer them the other cheek. That idea is gone, okay? I beg to differ, okay? Look at Romans 13, and I want you to see Paul's theology on Noah's theology. Okay, this is importante. So clearly we see Old Testament, God says, green light, capital punishment, okay? Chapter 13 of Romans, okay? Anybody got a big heading? What is chapter 13 about? Submission to authority. That authority in context here is government, okay? God establishes governments, okay? And he says as much. 13 verse 1. Every person is to be in subjection to the government authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist are established by God. So what do you think God says when he says every authority, every government authority is put in place by me? That's an interesting statement that we have a hard time living out, okay? Are the people that are currently ruling the United States put there by God? Yes. I don't care if you like him. I don't care if you dislike him. Doesn't matter my opinion about him either, okay? I may have voted for someone else. I may, whatever, right? Are the crazies that are running Egypt right now, okay, and Hezbollah and Iran, are they put in authority by God? That's what the text says, okay? I don't much care for them either. I would prefer people that were a little bit more pro-Israel, okay? But that's the reality. So God says, all government is established by me, and I put rulers in their places. Okay, keep reading in verse 2.
Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment.
Ooh. That, ever heard that verse before? How are we supposed to treat those in authority? We're not supposed to resist, okay? Now, is there a line in Scripture where we're called not to obey government? Yes, when it's calling us to violate clear biblical commandments, okay? So if they ever came and knocked on your door and said, abort your child, you know, kill your third-born girl, we can take issue, okay? To the point where government is not asking us to sin, Scripture says obey, okay? And if it ever gets to that point, then there's a higher calling, which is God, okay? It's the same with wives and husbands. Women, you submit to your husband's authority, who's hopefully following God. If husbands ever ask a wife to sin, then that's a different ballgame, okay? Keep going to verse 3.
For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval.
Is that true? Do you guys fear God, those of you that do well, or fear government? Anybody panic when we heard sirens this morning? Oh crap, they're kidding, got me, I'm dead, you know? Like, no, we're all okay, we realize, no. I'm living okay. I'm above board. That doesn't bug me, right? Woke me up last night. But aside from that, like, I don't fear going to jail today because I did nothing wrong. Okay? So I'm not worried about it. It causes no fear for me. Okay? However, verse 4. Okay, so end of verse 3, okay? It's their government's purpose is to bring about good. However, verse 4, keep going.
But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is a servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer.
What does that mean? My version doesn't say he, but it. It, government, does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Those of you that aren't breaking the speed limit, don't worry about it. Okay? Those of you that aren't murdering other people, you're fine. However, if you fall in that category, you need to rightly fear government because government does not bear the sword for nothing. They are an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Why would you need to fear government if you were a murderer? They have the right to take your life, as deemed by whom? God. What does it mean that they have the right to bear the sword? It means exactly what you think it means. Does Paul believe in capital punishment as given to the hands of government through God? Yes. Friends, that's New Testament. Okay? Like it or not, that's what that is. If you don't disobey, you're in good shape. If you do, you need to rightfully be worried because government has the right to take your life.
The American Revolution, so we say that was probably a direct disobedience to God.
Welcome to the unending debate at Dallas Theological Seminary. So, literally, I can't tell you how many hours have been spent on that discussion.
Really?
Yep. Yep.
Cool.
Yep. That's a great one to answer. Was the United States wrong to rebel against Great Britain? Some would say, absolutely, because it says obey government. Was government asking them to sin? I don't know. Was it unfair? I don't know. I don't know. We don't see a lot of commentary from God about the United States and Britain in Scripture, so you can ask him when you get there. But yeah, interesting question. I have no idea what the correct answer is. So.
So another question for you then. When it's talking about having the right to their being an avenger who carries out God's wrath, I mean, someone has to ask it to what extent,
yeah,
of God's wrath. I mean, does God's wrath that we're allowed to carry out only go up to a certain point?
Well, I would have to ask, what does it mean to bear the sword? It, that seems pretty clear to me. Why would you fear someone that had a sword? Because they have the ability to take your life. This isn't who bears the fraternity paddle and can put your hands on the chalkboard. This isn't who bears the, you know, key to the jail cell and can lock you up for 24 hours for being a, you know, knucklehead. The context seems to be very clear. You take another's life, Old Testament, it could cost you. New Testament, government still bears the sword. And by the way, that government was put in authority by God. Okay? Now, there are lots of corrupt governments that clearly don't obey God. That's a whole different subject for another day. But, okay, so just think through that, okay? Verse 6, God's heart is, rulers are servants of God. That would be ideal, okay? God-fearing men and women are in charge of government. They submit to God. We submit to them. Works very nicely, okay? It gets jacked when all of a sudden, like a husband who won't follow God, asks his wife to submit to him. Well, how dare you? How about you bow your knee to God first and then ask her to follow you? And in that order, right? So, okay? So just note the self. Wrestle with that one, lest you thought it was only Old Testament. It sure seems to show up in our New, okay? So you guys can land with that where you will. I certainly see room in Scripture for capital punishment to exist today, okay? I'm also from Texas, so. So, yes, add that to the things that we disagree with local seminaries, okay? Have lots of godly people there, ton of respect for them, okay? But we differ on other issues, okay? So, chapter 9, back to Genesis, okay? Fear God and fear the punishment of taking another's life because someone can take yours, okay? Now, verse 9, here comes the covenant. Here comes the promise from God. 9:9.
Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you. As many came out of the dark, out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth.
So there's the promise. That is the Noahic covenant. God says, Noah, this will never, ever happen again. Okay? The Noahic covenant is God will not destroy the earth with the flood again. Okay? And we see that. You fast forward all the way to Revelation. The earth is not going to end with water. It's going to end with, you know, fire and brimstone. Okay? So God is true to his promise even to the end. So the earth will be destroyed. He's not saying that's not going to happen, because it will, but not in the same manner. Okay? And there's a sign that goes along with this. Okay? And you guys probably read this in Sunday school. If not, this is kind of cool.
God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth.
So God puts his bow, or bow in this case. I love English sometimes. Like, I don't know, is it wind or wind? God puts his bow in the cloud, right? And says, it shall come about when a cloud were to cover the earth, and that you see the bow, you will remember the covenant, verse 15, between you and me, and know that I'm never going to destroy the earth again. What do you think happened the next time it rained? Like, oh, run, right? We're all going to die, you know? And God says, no. I'm going to put my bow, I'm going to put my weapon of warfare in the clouds to remind you I will never pick up that instrument of war again, okay? What is that bow? It's a rainbow, right? Okay? And there's some cool theology attached to it. So God's promise to us is, man, when you see that, we're to be reminded of a covenant that he made with Noah to never destroy the earth again like that, okay? It's a shame, by the way, my opinion, that sign has been attached to a very different meaning today, right? That's ours. As Christians, that is our symbol. As Jews, that is their symbol. Okay, it's a shame that it communicates a very different message today. Can we leave it at that? So, bummer. It is what it is. I don't know that we're getting it back, but God started that, and that was a promise from God that he would never bring harm to the earth again. Okay, so interesting promise from God. Okay, so they get that. God promises that and says, hey, I will not do that again. Okay, now here comes the, oh really, Noah? Doggone it. Verse 20, what does Noah do?
Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk and laid uncovered in his tent.
Like, whoa, what just happened, right? Planted a vineyard, okay, right, good so far. So you're a man of the earth, and you're doing what your forefathers did before you. Maybe this is your first experience with grapes, and you don't know what happens when they ferment, and you drink some grape juice that now is no longer grape juice but wine, and you have one, you're okay, you have six, and now it's like, oh boy, what just happened, right? So Noah gets off the boat, makes a sacrifice, plants a vineyard, and then however many months later, does what we talked about this morning in Proverbs, has a harvest, and makes wine, and drinks it, and gets rip-roaring drunk. So there you go, and basically passed out drunk naked. So congratulations, Noah. Okay, clearly the earth is more righteous than it was before, right? So good news. Noah's still got the same issues that you and I have, which is called a sin nature. So Noah, oddly enough, is not going to get Noah's not going to get rebuked for this. It's the action of his third-born son that is it's going to get the brunt of Noah's judgment, actually. Okay, so read what happens, 22 and following.
And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside.
So Noah is literally passed out drunk naked, okay? Ham, youngest son, comes up and is like, oh, wow, look, daddy's hammered and passed out, okay? And he's naked. Now, it's bad enough to be naked, right? In this society, that's a big deal, okay? You don't uncover yourself. They are a very, very modest society. If you guys have heard the story of Good Samaritan, there it is. Sorry, I had to get through my Rolodex. The guys that beat down this traveling person that we know very little about, this Samaritan, this person, whoever it is, more than likely did not leave him even naked. It would have been shameful and disgraceful to leave someone in that condition, okay? And you're not going to steal a guy's underwear anyway, right? You're not, those are of no value. You're not going to take them to the thrift store and say, here's some used skivvies. What can I get for these, right? The rest of the stuff would have been worth value, but in that culture, to uncover somebody, even when there's even honor among thieves, probably that idea, okay? So when someone is disrobed in this society, it's an even bigger deal. It would have been dishonoring for Noah. Ham sees it and comes back and tells Shem and Japheth about what happened to Dad, okay? Notice the response of Shem and Japheth. Read that.
Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father.
It's kind of an interesting picture. So these two guys get between one another, put a blanket, and they walk backwards to kind of cover their father. Why would they do that? Why would they walk that way? Yeah, just like literally, they're showing their father respect by not mocking his nakedness, okay? So they are covering their father, which would have been the appropriate response. So if they're handling it appropriately, obviously Ham did not. And you get what's inferred in the text is Ham was mocking his dad in a way, was making fun of his dad's sin. Clearly Noah was not in the right to do what he did, okay? So let's be clear on that. Ham takes it up a notch and is basically saying, come look at Dad. He's an idiot. He's passed out drunk, okay? Shem and Ham say, or Japheth say, listen, that's not okay, but we're not going to further dishonor him by making a mockery of his sin. Does that make sense? So Ham's about to get, his hands on the chalkboard and spanked, okay? There's been a lot of weird conjecturing that's come out of this text with what could have been the sin, but I think for our sakes, Ham was dishonoring his father by not appropriately handling the situation, okay, and making better of what was obviously a bad situation, okay? So they cover their dad's nakedness, 24. Noah wakes up and somehow realizes what his son has done, okay? So 24 has some interesting connotations too, and homosexuality has been mentioned and incest in this text and some weird stuff like that that I don't think is where the text is going. But Noah finds out what's happened in verse 25. Here's what he says.
Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant.
Okay. Sarah, no, that's great. And Ham's the secondborn. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, so he says, cursed be Canaan. Who is Canaan? Who comes from Canaan? Or where does Canaan come from, I should say? Ham, okay? So the Hamites, okay? Funny name. Come and ultimately bring about Canaan, the Canaanites that live in the land of Israel, that are a thorn in the flesh of Israel forever. They come from Ham, and they are cursed by God right here, okay? Cursed be Canaan, he shall be a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. So though you are second born, you're getting demoted to the bottom of the food chain, okay? So you're now going to be a servant. You're no longer going to have the privileges that would have come with the second born. We're going to treat you as a last, okay? Verse 26, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. Okay, the word Shem means the name, okay? Israel, as we know it, is going to come from Shem, okay? So Seth, Noah, Shem, Abram is ultimately going to come from this line, okay? So this is the line that God is choosing to bless, okay? And let Canaan be his servant, okay? So God has put the Canaanites ultimately underneath the rule of Israel, okay? So the Jews are going to come from that line. We know that there's going to be tension, but God has called them basically to rule over the Canaanites, okay? Japheth also gets a blessing, verse 27. Japheth means to enlarge, okay? So he's saying, you're going to get blessed for handling this well. Your territory is going to enlarge. Japheth were all the tribes. Ultimately, they're going to be to the north of Israel. I shouldn't say tribes, all the people. Tribes not as we know them in Israel. But like the area of the Black Sea up north, all the people groups that are north of Israel, the Japhethites are going to come from, they're going to come from the Japhethites, okay? So that's the idea. Shem, Ham, Japheth. Ham gets cursed. Canaanites come from Ham. Shem ultimately brings about Israel. He gets blessed, as does Japheth, for rightly handling what is a very weird situation in Scripture, okay?
So have theologians, so how do we get the different people groups today?
Hold that question. Chapter 11. It's coming. coming? Great question.
I guess I'm not understanding the context here, but it seems like Noah's the guy who was drunk. And like, I mean, maybe what Ham did wasn't very appropriate.
Yeah.
Seems like over the top.
Yep, you're right. And you see no rebuke from God for Noah's actions. And that's absolutely, your observation's absolutely right. They are wrong. And we know from other places in the Old Testament and the New that God's not a fan of us getting drunk and, right, that's not okay. For whatever reason, it's not dealt with by God. Whether that wasn't a part of the story in the theme of what was playing out, we don't see it in the text. So I don't know if Noah got dealt with, but it's clearly not justified. So to line up the rest of Scripture and say, well, that was okay, you go, no, God has an issue with it. For whatever reason, he doesn't deal with it here. So, yeah. So, again, different societies, different values. This was a big deal. To disrespect your parents, big deal. So, interesting.
I'm just wondering, the next part, where it says that Noah lived for 950 years. Mm-hmm.
A 120 days, then judgment. So the idea was in chapter 5, God says 120 days, I'm bringing judgment. And then in 120 years from that period is when Noah was born, and he was the one that God brought judgment during his lifetime. And now after this, we're going to see man's lifespan go like this. So it can mean both. But yeah, so he still lives a long time, and we're going to see those lifespans are going to slowly decrease and get down to what we're kind of used to. Okay.
So should Ham have covered up Noah? Is that like what he's hitting at?
Yeah. He should have found some way to respect his father and not disrespect him. So it's not a commentary on what Noah did. It's a commentary on the response as to how the sons responded to their father's sin.
So like for him to tell his other brothers, it's kind of like a gossip, or he should have just immediately covered.
Yeah, because Noah is the leader of the family.
Yeah.
Like, to respect them.
Yeah. When, what happens in the news when prominent Christians say something dumb or do something dumb? What happens? It's on every news channel. And it's like, Pat Robertson, blah, 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 says something dumb. You're like, oh, really? But everybody has to hear about it. Because the non-Christian community wants to make a mockery of the voice of the Christian community. And somehow all of us get lumped into one person's wrong comment or inappropriate comment. And you go, oh, really? Can we have like a shirts and skins team and we not be on that team and let him say dumb things, or whoever, right? Pick your person who said dumb things in the media, right? I'd probably be on that list too if people care. But, right, so that's what happens. So non-Christians love to see Christians make a mockery of themselves and fall and exalt their sin. And that's what Ham did. He exalted his dad's sin and said, look at that, that's awful. Guys, come look, right? And they said, no, we're going to respect our father. So yeah. And again, very different values in this culture. Hospitality, very, very high value. United States, it's like, eh. It's just different.
So, like, do we, like, just clarify the gaps here? Did, like, Noah's sons tell him that
I've got to assume so. Either God revealed it to him or his son said, Dad, here's what happened. You know, why am I naked? Why is a blanket on me? What just happened? Why are all these wine bottles empty? You know, somehow he got the information, right? Something, that was grape juice yesterday. I don't know what happened. You know, I think Noah knew what he's doing. I think he's a sinner. So, and he'd been on a boat for 377 days. He was like, you know what, the heck with it. Right? I don't know. But He made a bad choice. I think he knew what he was doing, and for whatever reason, so, okay. Chapter 10. Okay, let's kind of get through this. Let's see if we can get to your question about the people groups that are coming. Okay. Chapter 10. We're going to see sons of Japheth 1-5, sons of Ham 6-20, and 21-32 is Shem. Okay. So here's again genealogies. A whole chapter on here's who begot whom on these people, okay? So you see, beginning with Japheth, okay, Japheth was the son, the last-born son that gets blessed in this fallout, okay? Sons of Japheth, verse 2, were Gomer and Magog, okay? So again, north of Israel, even, you see lots of names mentioned. So not of huge importance. Where is the one that I mentioned? Is it, I thought I underlined it. I know I did. Where did I write that down? Welcome to 2:30 in the morning. Where did you put that, Michael? I think it's verse 2. Madai, M-A-D-A-I. I believe that is also, no, it's, that's not right either. Okay, never mind. Anyway, these are the northern tribes that live north of Israel, okay? Or people groups is probably a better word for our context, okay? Six now and following, you see Ham. Okay, notice who comes from Ham, okay? Cush, Mizpah, Put, Canaan, okay? Verse 6. Verse 8, look who shows up. Nimrod, okay? There you go. It is biblical, okay? Nimrod means let us rebel, okay? Not a good name, okay? Let us rebel. Nimrod, you're a Nimrod, right? So there's a context behind it. Verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, let Nimrod be a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, or Babel, okay? Babel means, it literally just means like gibberish. That's the meaning of the word in Hebrew, okay? So from Nimrod, this guy that says, let us rebel, he starts Babel, which is in Shinar or present day, or Babylon in the biblical picture, okay? Also Assyria, verse 11 is mentioned there. Okay, so from the sons of Ham come Babylon and Assyria. Okay, if you know anything about Babylon and Assyria, not good in terms of Jewish history. Okay, no bueno. Okay, Nineveh is mentioned in there as a city. There it is, verse 13. That's the word I thought I mentioned. Mizraim, 13, is Egypt. Okay, these are the people that ultimately become the Egyptians. Okay, so these come from this people group. Okay, and then 21 and following, is all about Shem, okay? Back real quick to 18, you see again the Canaanites mentioned, okay? So Egypt, Syria, Babylon, Canaanites all come from Ham, and then Shem is the line that ultimately gets blessed, okay? And you'll see kind of a laying out of their people, and Israel is the people group, one of the people groups that's going to come from them.
On verse 8, it says, Cush father Nimrod, he was the first on earth to become a mighty man. Does that have anything to do with the...
David's? No, I don't think so. Different. This just has the sense of he's a hunter. Is there anything to do with the Nephilim? Are we rewinding the tapes of the Nephilim? No, we're going to see a mighty people group again. They're going to be isolated on the Philistine coast, so they're not gone. So whatever genes were available and Noah and his kids produced again some type of big, giant group of people that the author of Deuteronomy, Moses, says, yeah, those are giants. Those are the Nephilim, okay? Now, whether they actually were the Nephilim or they were compared to the Nephilim, like they were like those people, I don't know. But we're going to see big, strong, tough guys again that have really big coffins and have to duck when they walk underneath the basketball net, okay? They're huge, okay? So for what it's worth. All right, so Shem, Ham, and Japheth, we won't go into reading all that, okay? There's a lot of names. If we were good Jews, we would read them all and dissect them. These really, like, we blow over these texts to a Jew. This is important, okay? And not that it's not important to us, it's scripture, but it doesn't have the same value for us. Even today, right? Like, these tensions are still there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, crazy, right? This stuff is still very much around, okay?
I need to rewind the tape mm-hmm. for a second. Going back, so, Moses cursed Canaan, right?
God?
And blessed Shem and Japheth, and Ham just wasn't mentioned in there at all. So Ham was still alive, and we get to this next part here, and it goes through the generations of him, so we just assume he just kind of went on living his life, even though he was the one.
Yeah, he doesn't die.
His
line gets cursed as a result of it. Yeah, so he doesn't die. God doesn't kill him. Yeah. Just gets cursed down the line. Which is tough, right? I mean, welcome to living in the shrapnel of your great-grandfather's really dumb decision. That's got to be tough, okay? All right, chapter 11. Let's find out where these people groups come from, okay? Now, real quick, chapter 1's about... Rewind the tapes with me. Chapter 1 of Genesis is about God. Chapter 2 is... Chapter 3, sin, 3:15. Redemption, 4 and 5. Civilizations, 6 through 9. What did we just read? Judgment, okay? 6 through 9, judgment. 10 and 11 are now about nations, races, and pagan religions, okay? Nations, we just read about, okay? We're about to read about races. Where do they come from? Why are some people white, some people black, some people purple, and everything in between, right? Where do they come from, okay? Why do we have different dialects? Why do we have different languages? Why do we have, you know, different cultures? Where do they come from, okay? Chapter 11, and then where do we get pagan religions from, okay? All this is going to come to fruition here, okay? Tower of Babel, 11:1, okay? Read that.
Now the whole earth uses the same language.
Okay, so right now, everybody speaks... If you're a Jew, they believe it's Hebrew, okay? Everybody speaks Hebrew right now. I don't know what they spoke. I don't know if Adam spoke Hebrew or if he spoke, no idea, okay? If you ask Ronan, when we go to Israel, it's Hebrew. Hebrew is God's language, okay? So, whatever. It's not English, okay? I know that much, all right? So they all speak the same language and use the same words. So everyone on the earth can speak and interact with one another, okay? As a result, what happens? Okay, this is Babylon, Shinar, okay? So they settle. Now, what was God's command? Don't settle, do what? Be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth, okay? It's the same tendency that we saw after the flood in Cain's descendants. You know what? No, if you think Cain was awesome, Lamech says, I'm a bad mamma jamma. I'm going to kill a guy for striking me. If he was avenged seven times, me 77, I'm going to stop. I'm going to settle. And God says, no. We're not having that, okay? These guys do the same thing. They settle and they begin to build a city, okay? Verse 3, this is 3 and 4 give you some commentary on what they think of their city. Okay, so interesting commentary here. Come, let's build this city, verse 3. They use basically what they have, and that's kind of the commentary there. They have what natural resources they have. They use those to build the city. Verse 4, what's the impression you get with their attitudes? What's going on here? They think, yeah, we're a pretty big deal. We're going to make a name for God? No, we're going to make a name for us, ourselves, our city. We're going to make a tower that's going to go where? The gods will be impressed with us. We're going to build a tower that will reach into the sky, a gateway to the gods. This will reach all the way to the heavens, okay? We're going to make a name for ourselves because if we don't, what's going to happen? Yeah, we'll be dispersed. Like, by the way, God said to be dispersed. So if we don't disobey, then we'll have to obey, right? It's an odd commentary, okay? But they're afraid that they're going to get weeded out with all these other people groups, okay? So there's probably the idea that though they spoke the same language, not everybody's friends. There's only so many resources. You're hunting and gathering and what have you, and there was fear. There's protections in numbers. So there still was this idea of, yeah, building makes some sense. Protection makes some sense. You know, hey, Joe, go gather some fruit. Where'd Joe go? Boy, Joe didn't come back. Why didn't Joe come back? I don't know. Maybe those other people over there ate him, or I don't know. But there's some fear or what have you that's going on that's causing these people to stop and say, you know what, we're going to build something for ourselves that'll be impressive so that our name will be exalted, other people know who we are, other people will fear us, and what have you, okay? So they're going to build in Babylon, in Babel, in Shinar, again, this deal. Now, Rick's going to come in a few weeks. He's going to teach you guys about kind of the background of a lot of the story, so I won't ruin it all. But the background from which this takes place and then where Abraham is ultimately plucked from is pretty fascinating. So I'll save it. Yeah. And I'm with you. I think there's a natural connection there. I don't know that that's why that this text is here, but as an application point, there's a tendency for us to gather. As Christians, as pagans, it would have been safer together than it would have been to go out. I can see that. I'm with you. So God, this is a pretty humorous commentary. Remember, they're going to build a tower that's going to reach the heavens. God's commentary, verse 5.
Behold, they are one people, and they all have language.
Back up one verse for me.
Oh, sorry. And the Lord came down to see the city.
The Lord what? Came down. They're going to build a tower that's going to reach the heavens. God has to come down to get to it. So there's a little bit of Hebrew humor there. Like, guys, it's really not that tall. It's not that big a deal. You think you're a big deal. Nobody else thinks you're a big deal. Okay? I have to come down to come see what you have done. Okay? So he sees this tower, okay, that they had built. Verse 6, keep going. So what's God saying about this action in terms of the languages, what they can do? Is this positive or negative in God's eyes?
It's negative in that it's the beginning of what they will do, meaning that, okay, if we allow this to continue, it's just going to get worse and worse.
Exactly, okay. So God destroys the world with a flood. We start over. Noah, 3 kids, 3 wives. All evils eradicated from the face of the earth. No, not so much. We still have a sin nature. People gravitate towards that. People are now doing something that God did not want them to do. Subdue the earth, spread out. No, we're going to settle. We're going to build a tower. We're going to make a name for us and not God. God says, man, this is not good. They're pretty creative at sinning. So if I continue to allow them to sin with no restrictions, apparently being together, speaking the same language, it just helped them sin quicker with greater abundance. So God says, this is not good. I need to put a restraint, if you will, on their sin, something that will inhibit their ability, okay? So here's what God does, verse 7.
Come, let us go down there and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech.
So what does God do? And does what? What does it mean to confuse their language? The idea is, man, JD and I used to be able to talk. He'd speak Hebrew, I speak Hebrew. Now he's speaking French. What? Or whatever, okay? I can't understand him anymore. Am I going to hang out with him if I can't understand him? No, go away. Who in here speaks Hebrew? Okay, you're now my new best friend, okay? And we're going to hang together. And all the French people are going to go hang together. And all the people that speak whatever are going to, they're going to pocket together. So what happens is when everyone can speak the same language, we're all together. There's a natural division that occurs between people with languages, and now they're going to separate and settle in other places. So God has stopped the erection of this building and the erection of their sin. It's just, you see what he's doing? He's making them huddle together and break up into smaller pockets. Who's Ann? The same us that was in Genesis 1. I think it's the Godhead. Okay? We're going to go confuse their language. Okay, by the way, confuse and Babel come from kind of the same root word. Babel means to confuse or blah, 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 blah. Let's go down and let's go make one person's language sound like gibberish to another. Okay, so we're going to confuse their speech. Okay, the Lord scattered them from the face of the earth and they stopped building the city, which was God's goal for their sin to slow, if you will. Okay, therefore, its name was called Babel because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad from the face of the earth. Okay, now, we get a very clear commentary on where the languages come from. Right there. God created now different languages. Now, he didn't turn that people one color and make that people have long black hair and, you know, put all the Swedes over there and now they're all blonde hair and blue eyed or whatever. The idea is that probably would have happened either via microevolution like we see in species. You know, you stick a cheetah in, you know, a snow environment and one in the jungle, and over time their fur turns different colors. You've got white cats and they learn how to survive in their environment. There's micro adaptations that they make. Could have been from that. Or God could have literally on the spot created different people groups with different languages to further divide them. I don't know for sure, but we at least see the beginning of God saying, we're going to separate peoples. We're going to make distinctions between everyone being the same. Clearly with languages. The other stuff that comes with that, dialects, skin color, those types of things, I think there's room for it here in the text, though it's not explicitly, you know, stated, okay? So that's my thought. Nations, now we're beginning to develop. Different people groups come from here. Races, I think, come from here as well, okay? Now, here's the cool thing. If you were to look at, if you were to incorrectly interpret the sin of Cain with him getting a mark on him and saying, God made Cain some type of different skin color in order to distinguish him from the rest of the skin colors around him, regardless of what that was. Was that a good thing or a bad thing that Cain did? Bad. So that would have been, in a sense, a gosh, this is bad. Why is God doing what he's doing here? Why is God slowing the process of evil?
Because it's a good thing.
It's a slight distinction, but I want you guys to see this. This is an act of grace from God to say, if I don't restrain your sin, nobody will. You will sin to the nth degree, and I'm going to make it harder for you to do that. So by changing your languages, by changing your races, by separating you, this is an act of grace in the midst of a sinful environment to slow the process of sin. So the answer then to various different races and nations is not a punishment or a put down on one people group over another. It's God's answer to the world's problem of sin, saying, this is how I am choosing to slow the process of evil. It's exactly what government is. Does government fix our sin? No. Does it hopefully inhibit evil in some people? Yes, okay, because people can rightly fear consequences. If you didn't have a strong conscience and you realized there is no punishment for my sin, well, gosh, why not go rob a bank? Why not have a bunch of money? Why not go steal things? If there's no punishment, I have nothing to fear. God says, no. We're going to inhibit your sin by putting punishments in place, by putting inhibitors in place, if you will. Does that make sense? Yeah. It gives God a greater opportunity to demonstrate his love for all of humankind. So yeah, let that blow your minds for a little bit. Can God use the sinful actions of humanity to accomplish his will? Not just can he does, and he allows it to be so, at the same time not being responsible for mankind's sin. He is not the primary mover, or he is not to blame because of the choices that man makes, right? So the old saying, and you heard it from Jeff, I think, the other day, can God hit a straight lick with a crooked stick? Absolutely. Can God use sinners like us to accomplish his will? Absolutely. Even when we're outside of his will? Yes. And is that part of his plan? Yes. It's not by accident, okay? So it's fascinating at times how God chooses to work. He could pick the straight A, you know, nose clean, you know, moral people of the world. Instead, he uses you and me. So, or at least me. I don't know where you fall in that total pool. I'm closer to the bottom.
Do you have, the people here, did they know the story of Noah?
Oral tradition is very important in this environment, so I would assume so. That's their entertainment at night. You sit around and tell stories about your grandparents. So. Yeah, I mean, do we do the same thing? I mean, you just, you right on the heels of sin, it's like, oh gosh, I'll never do that again.
Well,
I'm sure they were talking about the. I'm sure that that would have been mentioned in the story of Noah, is the covenant God made with them, so they'd be like, oh, well, we don't have to. God's not going to do it, so he said so.
Yeah. Yeah, he's never going to destroy the earth again, so yeah. It's the same tendency that's in all of us, right? It's the same reason why we can look at Rome and go, boy, look what they did to destroy their society, and then we can drop previous societies like that in the United States and go, boy, that looks really similar. Maybe we shouldn't redo that, right? I think we can predict what's going to happen if we continue down those roads, but yet we'll do them anyway, in different ways, and it may not be same, but you know, when sin gets out of hand, there's a point where societies just kind of implode. And we're heading down that path quickly, unfortunately. So, okay, so there you go, all right? Now, out of that, okay, you see Babel. Verse 10, in the midst of that, here are the descendants of Shem, kind of the rest of the story. You get a whole list of people, and the characters that become very important for us are chapter 11, verse 24. Okay, somebody pick up there. Okay, now are you seeing something change with lifespans? Now they're giving birth at 29 as opposed to 629, right? So lifespans have changed since the flood, okay? So Nahor, okay, is the first guy we see. 29 years old, he becomes the father of Terah, okay? Keep going.
And after he became the father of Terah, Nahor lived 119 years and had other sons and daughters.
Okay.
After Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran.
Okay, so we'll know those guys well. Okay, Abram is our old friend Abraham, and we're going to find out what God's going to do with this joker and how he's going to use him to change the world. Okay, so more on him tomorrow. We'll pick up in 11:27 and following and watch his story. But Abraham, okay, is from the line of Shem, and God has now got his hand on that line, and he's going to take a guy that is kind of the least and the last and one that you would not expect, and he's going to use this guy to do something crazy. Okay? So tomorrow, Abraham, we will pick up there. All right? God bless you guys. Have a great day. Live long and prosper.